Now it's time for the TuxCast special feature. This month, the TuxCast peeps over the fence to look at the professionals who manage the wealth of the world's richest people. Like their clients, they usually like to keep a low profile. What's it like serving people who have everything? It's estimated that 1% of the world's population will own more than 50% of the world's wealth by 2016. And there's a small army of wealth managers who work for them. Not very much is known about the part they play in exacerbating global inequality, but Associate Professor of Copenhagen Business School, Brooke Harrington, wanted to get inside this closed world. So she trained to be a wealth manager.
Well, there didn't seem to be any other way to study what I wanted to study, because people who are committed professionally to discretion and client confidentiality aren't going to answer questions by strange sociologists who phone them up.
Right. So you did years of training. You went to conferences and meetings. You were eating with them, taking classes with them, staying in the same hotels as these wealth managers. Immersion ethnography, you call it. So studying them at close quarters. And there aren't so many of these wealth managers in the world, really. Probably only about 20,000.
Well, there are not that many people who can pay for this sort of work. I think the number of ultra high net worth individuals, which means those with assets of 30 million US or more, not including their primary residence, there are only just over 100,000 of them in the world. And as for high net worth individuals, which are the larger category of people with 1 million or more US in investable assets, I think there are a couple million of those, but it's not a massive client base. It's not totally knowable how many wealth managers there are in the world. It's only knowable how many belong to this professional society that I studied. So that 20,000 figure, as you said, is relative to the membership of STEP.
And the motivations of some of these wealth managers are really interesting. Some of them were looking for a better work-life balance, and going into wealth management offered them that.
Many people spoke openly about how when they were just in straight law or straight finance, they were working 80 or 90 hour weeks. They made a lot more money, but they never saw their families. And one of the things that made a big impression on them from working with ultra high net worth clients was that often those people had very strained or dysfunctional relationships with their family members, especially with their children and their spouses, and that they, the wealth managers, didn't want that for themselves. They wanted better human relationships, and they got that by, you know, going from like corporate law or from financial trading into wealth management, because it's more of a 40-hour week kind of gig.
What kind of salaries were they on, these wealth managers?
I have an idea from looking at the job want ads that you see sometimes in the financial papers in places like Switzerland or in the professional journals. Now, granted, some people would say that the very best jobs are not advertised at all. And they demand really extraordinary things, like people who are multilingual and highly cultured and with many years of experience, like more than a decade of experience working with wealthy people. And they're offering compensation in the mid to low six figures, like $200,000 or $300,000 US a year. And I compare that to the average salary for a managing director, which is like a mid-level executive at Goldman Sachs, is about $500,000 a year. And that doesn't even include the bonuses they get, which are usually double that. So, you don't really get rich working this way for rich people. You make a lot more money working in corporate law or working in high finance, like being a currency trader.
Still a higher income than most people, but not as much as I thought it might be. And you describe wealth management as a profession on the defensive, which is good to hear. But why do you say that?
Well, I think the reputation of people involved in finance generally is pretty low these days, but there's a a perception, particularly that people who are involved in facilitating tax avoidance and law avoidance are engaged in something that, even if it's not strictly illegal, is definitely ethically unsavory. I encountered a lot of resentment and bitterness on the part of people I interviewed. They're very acutely aware that when they tell people what they do, if they don't just say, I'm a lawyer, but they say, I'm a wealth manager, or I work for wealthy people, there's a kind of stigma attached to that, especially if people know exactly what they do for wealthy people, which is helping them avoid legal restrictions.
Right, because it's not just about fixing it so that their clients pay little or no tax. I mean, people like Mitt Romney, the presidential hopeful and multimillionaire, famously paying less personal income tax than most US citizens. But wealth management, you say, is also about facilitating a kind of stateless, lawless lifestyle.
Tax avoidance was really only the tip of the iceberg. I didn't realize how much bigger the problem is, that it really what wealth managers do extend to much more generally to law avoidance in general. And that creates problems of legitimacy for whole governments, because it's bad enough when people think that they're getting shafted because the rich aren't paying their fair share of taxes. It's quite another matter when you say to people, well, there's one law for the rich and one law for everybody else, and they're not the same. I think that's the kind of thing that can potentially topple governments and lead to crises in politics. If you're wealthy at a sufficient level, you're essentially a tourist across the world. You don't have to feel obligated to contribute to any society. If you don't feel rooted in a particular country, you're like a tourist everywhere you go. You take the benefits of being in a certain place, and you don't feel obligated to contribute to the upkeep of that way of life. So, you know, you may go to, I don't know, some island in the Caribbean, enjoy the sun and sand, and then you leave. So you don't pay income tax there. You wouldn't feel obligated to do so because you're not a citizen of that place. Well, imagine that sort of vacation mentality generalized to an entire way of life.
Right, because one of many things wealth managers are facilitating are passports of convenience, a service many traditional tax havens are pushing quite hard because of the low or no income tax advantages they offer. When the Facebook founder Eduardo Saverin renounced his US citizenship for a Singaporean passport, that was, you say, a classic wealth management strategy. Here's a quick reminder.
And in the big finish tonight, this story gets my blood boiling. Facebook co-founder Eduardo Saverin has renounced his United States citizenship. Facebook is going to go public on Friday. And by giving up his citizenship, Saverin will avoid paying taxes on billions of dollars on capital gains. Singapore, they have no capital gains taxes, even though the capital gains tax in this country is at a historically low rate.
The numbers don't lie. Saverin has turned his back on the country that welcomed him and kept him safe, educated him, and helped him become a billionaire. This is a great American success story gone horribly wrong.
And the very rich don't need to worry too much about expensive divorce settlements or lawsuits either, because their wealth managers can ensure their assets are untouchable pretty much no matter what. For example, Brooke Harrington points out in her research how no one, not even the US government, has ever broken a Cook Islands trust. Now, I'm sure there are very wealthy people who are honourable, but there are many instances as well where the fees they pay their wealth managers have bought them all sorts of offshore vehicles and anonymity to be able to do things like protect the proceeds of crime, pay bribes, avoid legal judgments and debts, and of course, dodge taxes. So, Brooke, you did 65 interviews in 18 countries for your research. Where did these wealth managers kind of draw the line? Did any of them express any kind of remorse or doubt about the type of work they were doing?
Some of them did. There was a spectrum of responses ranging from people who were very much, they felt very misunderstood, and they were very angry about how they felt their work was portrayed publicly as being immoral, helping people pay less tax than the statutory rate. And they were very resentful of moral arguments that cast their work in a negative light. On the other end of the spectrum, I also encountered people who were conscience-stricken about their role in helping the rich stay rich in a world of growing inequality. And they were taking active measures to try to undo some of the damage that they felt their clients were doing in the world. So one person I interviewed was very direct about encouraging his clients to give generously to philanthropic causes. Another person I interviewed would actually lecture his clients about inequality, and he'd talk to them about Amartya Sen and the work of people like Joseph Stiglitz to try and, you know, do some sort of consciousness raising with wealthy people about their role in a larger system of socioeconomic inequality. So he took a sort of educator role. Other people would make sort of small gestures that were mostly symbolic, like refusing to sign off on certain documents that they thought were unethical, knowing that there were other people in their organizations who would sign off on those documents. So the client would get what they wanted, but the individual practitioner could console him or herself that their hands were clean.
And one of the wealth managers you interviewed told you he'd said to his colleagues, if I ever become like our clients, just shoot me.
Yeah, that fellow was very contemptuous of some of his clients. Not all of them, but definitely some of them he regarded as being just deeply corrupt and unsavory people.
And one wealth manager in the British Virgin Islands threatened to kind of have you thrown out of the country. Why was that?
This was one of the guys who was super defensive about what he perceived as an injustice done to him personally and to the profession generally by virtue of having what he called my leftist perspective on his work. And that consisted, it seemed, entirely of my using the words wealth management and socioeconomic inequality in the same sentence. This gentleman, at the end of our interview, he sort of leaned back and crossed his arms again and told me that there had been discussions among the wealth managers I had contacted in this small community on the British Virgin Islands about having me thrown off the island because of my views about the profession. So he didn't name names or say explicitly whose idea this had been, but he didn't seem exactly horrified by the prospect. He wasn't telling me in order to express his objections to the idea, if you see what I mean.
Right. And like many of the enabler professions in the tax avoidance industry, wealth managers exploit the law in ways that were never intended by lawmakers. And quite possibly they're doing things that might not survive a challenge in court, if it ever got to court. And even if it did, they probably made sure the money of their clients is out of reach of the law enforcement bodies. What kind of effect does that have, do you think?
Wealth managers defeat the letter of the law while remaining within it. If there isn't a sense of solidarity, if there is a sense that there is a law that is just simply not applicable to a certain segment of society, then you're breaking down the solidarity and legitimacy on which democracies depend. And that opens the door for things like fascism, not as an automatic development, but it creates some of the conditions that allow fascism to thrive. And that's very worrisome.
That's Associate Professor of Copenhagen Business School, Brooke Harrington. She'll be publishing more on her research next year. You've been listening to The Taxcast from the Tax Justice Network. We'll be back next month.